This is NHL Induction Class. Conversations with the Hockey Hall of Fame Class of 2024. Here's Kenny Albert.
Thanks so much for joining us. Jeremy Roenick is widely considered one of the greatest American-born hockey players of all time. In 20 NHL seasons, Roenick scored 513 goals and 1,216 points, ranking him top five all-time among Americans in both categories. A nine-time NHL All-Star, Roenick competed in two Olympic Games, helping Team USA to a silver medal in 2002. He followed his playing career with a 10-year stint as a broadcaster for NBC. In our conversation, Jeremy and I discuss why he turned down Wayne Gretzky as a 15-year-old junior player and how fear bred his punishing style of play. Here's my conversation with Jeremy Roenick. JR, first of all, congratulations. What did it mean to you to finally get the call informing you that you were elected into the Hockey Hall of Fame?
To tell you the truth, you know, Kenny, you know me for a long time, and usually I have a word or a phrase or an opinion about everything. That question, I don't think words can really put into how I felt when I got the call. There was fear, there was nerves, there was heavy palm sweating, there was tears, I was speechless. And to tell you the truth, I don't think it's really hit me all in once, you know, yet. I think standing up on stage in front of all my friends and family and, you know, the hockey world, it will be very difficult for me to hold myself together. But I will tell you, I'm humbled. I am the gratitude that I have inside and the way that I feel and the way that it made me feel to hear those words come from Lanny McDonald's mouth was overwhelming and very emotional.
Well, take us back to the start of a Hall of Fame career during your childhood. You moved around a bit due to your dad's job, Virginia for a while. You commuted to play for the New Jersey Rockets, then high school in Boston. What are some of the biggest memories from that period, the early portion of your hockey life?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot, Kenny, because obviously going into the Hall of Fame speech, you have to talk a little bit about your past and about your youth. And growing up on the East Coast was really fortunate for me. Great hockey in Boston, you know, traveling up and down the East Coast through New Jersey, Connecticut, New York, Philly, you know, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C. was awesome for me. To be able to play for the New Jersey Rockets with some of my other friends, we won two Bantam National Championships back to back. To be able to play in the Pee Wee tournament when I was a young kid and you know, score eight goals in one game. You know, these were all the great memories that I thought about. But, you know, then heading to Thayer Academy and connecting with Tony Amonte was life-changing for me. I think it changed the course of my development immensely. And the two of us, you know, you'll hear me say he's my soulmate of wingers, and there's no question about it. It really changed my attitude towards hockey. It changed my the way that I wanted to play, my grit, my tenacity, my desire to win. And then we won two New England championships at Thayer, and you know, lost in the third. And then the next thing you know, I'm in Chicago. So it went by really fast, but it was a great. It was great being able to play in so many different areas. We did move like seven or eight times before I was 13. So I got to play in many different areas of the East Coast and got to, you know, really experience all different types of hockey, levels of hockey, and different, you know, met a lot of good people. So it was good for me as a young kid.
Now, you were 10 years old when the United States won gold in Lake Placid. Were you watching the game? Do you remember where you were?
Again, you're hitting all my bullet points that I'm going to be talking in my speech. But yes, it was, I remember I was sitting in my living room in Richfield, Connecticut, and I had all my equipment on because we actually had a game and we had to all wait to the end of the game to watch the finish. And after the game was over, it was like race to the rink and all the cars came into the arena and into the parking lot at the same time. And there were 40 Mike Ruzioni is running around the ice at that time, you know, just that when they beat the Russians in 1980, which really, I think, sparked the generation my generation to really want to be an Olympian, want to be a National Hockey League player. And I think it was my generation that put us on the world map of being a hockey dynasty and being a world power. You know, you look at Tony Monty, Keith Tkachuk, Chris Chelios, Mike Modano, just an amazing array. Brian Leetch, I mean, Billy Guerin, Dougie Waite, you can go on, Mike Richter. I mean, our generation, not only just winning the 96 World Cup, but being in the 2002 gold medal game of the Olympics, probably the biggest stage in sports history. And we were on it against our arch rival Canadians. It was a pretty unbelievable transformation from 10 years old until that 2002 time.
Now, when you were 15, Wayne Gretzky took you to breakfast in Boston. He was trying to recruit you for his junior team.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, right? So, you know, Mike Modano decided to go to Prince Albert, and it was that time where there was a few guys in the United States that were trying to that the junior leagues were trying to recruit. Gretz heard about me. Charlie Henry, who was the GM, heard about me, and Charlie Henry's like, calls Gretz to say, you're going to be in Boston. There's a kid that we want to bring up here to Hall. You should take him out. Let's take him out for breakfast, bring him to the game. And I got this call. It was like out of nowhere. You know, Wayne Gretzky's coming to Boston Garden. He wants you to come to breakfast and he's going to bring you in the locker room. And I'm like 15 years old. And Wayne Gretzky is courting me to go play on his junior team in Quebec. It was the coolest thing in the world, to tell you the truth. The only bad thing is I had to say no to him. My mom and dad didn't want me to leave and go play major junior. We wanted to have that aspect to be able to go play college hockey, not knowing what was going to happen. And telling Wayne Gretzky no was very, very difficult. Obviously, they still drafted me. And I went there after a short stint with the Hawks. So I did get to play there. But it's really cool to be in the Edmonton Oilers locker room with Wayne Gretzky sitting next to you, which was really kind of crazy because at 15, 3 years, 4 years later, 5 years later, you know, I'm 4 years later, I'm lining up right across from him. And 6 years later, I'm sitting in an All-Star game in Chicago Blackhawks locker room with him sitting right next to me, my first All-Star game, 6 years after he was trying to get me to play in Hall. It's kind of weird how all that kind of, you know, comes a full circle.
And then you wound up playing for him. He was your head coach with the Coyotes. Yeah. What was that like?
Yeah, it was interesting. It was interesting. I mean, we didn't have a very good team. I thought, you know, Gretz was put in a very difficult situation, you know, being an owner, then coming in to try to be the coach, to try to bring attention to the team. Our team was not very good. As I said, I thought he probably, you know, it was a ploy to bring me in maybe to sell more tickets because of my popularity there through the late 90s. It didn't work. I totally love Gretz. Him and I are very good friends, and I respect the hell out of him for being the face of our sport for so long. But he wasn't my favorite coach ever because he never put me on the line, played me very sparingly, and I was probably in the best shape I've been in years going into that season. I realized that it was more of a ticket sell signing more than a, you know, player signing.
Now take us back to your first NHL game. You're drafted in the first round, 18 years old, October 1988. What do you remember about that night?
Well, it was I scared to death. Number one, obviously I'm dying because here I am 18 years old. I just 4 months out of high school, out of my junior high school. Like, and so I finished my last class in high school 4 months earlier. Now here I am playing the New York Rangers for the Chicago Blackhawks. And I'm 160 pounds soaking wet. And I remember going in the bathroom, throwing up. I was so nervous, excited, but not knowing what I was really getting into. I didn't realize what I was getting into just coming to Chicago at such a young age. In that time, you know, of the league, it was a very tough time in the league. It was physical, it was mean. It was obviously the salaries were lower. Disclosure hadn't happened. So the competition was immense. Guys were fighting for jobs and literally fighting for jobs. And, you know, you had to learn to be a man really quick. So I remember that first game. I was like, I don't know if I can make it. Can I do it? Am I going to be able to make it? And you always question yourself. And, you know, I questioned myself for a while, but turns out after a quick stint with Hull, going down to the minors, playing in an amazing World Junior tournament that same year. Coming back, I was ready, and I lit the league on fire once I came back halfway through the season.
You were surrounded by some great players during your early years with the Hawks: Denny Savard, Doug Wilson, Steve Larmer, many, many others. What was it like having those guys as teammates?
Well, you know, everybody says, and it's true, you can't achieve greatness without help. You can't become a great player without somebody taking you under their wing and teaching you the ropes. And I had some great people that really took me under their wing and showed me the ropes when I was 18 years old. You mentioned a couple of them: Steve Larmer, Michelle Galais, Doug Wilson, Dennis Savard, Dirk Graham, Troy Murray were amazing leaders for me. The way that they played, the way that they looked at the game, their integrity, their leadership was amazing. Chris Chelios coming really changed me as a person and as a player. He showed me what real leadership and dedication and determination is needed, and love for the game. Chelly is still probably my most favorite teammate of all time, my hero, for a lot of different reasons. There are a couple other guys up there. I mentioned Tony Amonte, Joe Thornton, but Chelly has a very, very huge spot in my heart from my playing days and still today. So I had a great, you know, Dave Manson, you know, one of my favorite defensemen I ever played with. You know, having guys like Stu Grimson and Wayne Van Dorp and Cam Russell and Mike Peluso be able to protect me those years. You know, these are all the guys that helped me do what I did and helped me be as good a player as I possibly could have been.
And that was a trade that shocked the hockey world. Chris Chelios for Denny Savard back in 1990.
Yeah, it was kind of one of those crazy trades where Chicago kind of was like, what? You're giving up, you know, savoir-faire everywhere. I mean, he was the face of the team. He was the superstar. But getting back a superstar and a defenseman that was from Chicago, it kind of allowed, you know, because Chelly was from Chicago and they were getting a homegrown guy, I think Keenan got a pass from the fans because of that. And it was nice because Savvy came back to finish his career with the Hawks in 95-96, which was a nice fitting after going off and winning a Stanley Cup. You know, it was nice that it worked out for everybody, but it was definitely a shocker. And for me, they made that trade because of the way I was playing, right? They knew that they had somebody to kind of replace Savvy's shoes and as the offense went. I never like to admit that, but that's, you know, that's kind of the reasoning for the decision to do that.
You mentioned Mike Keenan. He was your head coach your first four seasons, including 91-92. You scored a career high 53 goals, went to the Stanley Cup final. What was it like playing for Iron Mike?
Scary. Absolutely scary. Mike Keenan was Iron Mike for a reason. He coached with an iron fist. He didn't want you to be comfortable at any aspect of the game, whether it was in the locker room with the boys or whether it was on the ice. He kept you on your toes. He wanted to be a very physical team. He wanted to be a mean team. He wanted to be an intimidating team. And he coached that way. He didn't give you any slack. He was an intense person and he demanded hard work. And, you know, even if it was negative energy, I mean, Mike's comment to us a lot was negative energy is better than no energy at all. So you had to be on your toes and you had to play the style of game that Mike Keenan wanted. And if you didn't, you weren't going to play. It was just basic, simple math. It's either do what play the way he wants you to play, or you're going to find yourself either in the press box or on a plane to another team.
After eight seasons in Chicago, you headed west to Phoenix, your first stint with the Coyotes. You touched on your second stint with Phoenix earlier. And then it was on to Philly and L.A. What are some of your biggest memories from the time you spent with the Flyers and the Kings?
You know, stepping into Philly was spectacular for me. I'm going into one of the rowdiest fan bases in all of sports. I remember talking to the media and them saying, are you nervous or intimidated about the sports media here in Philly? Because they can be pretty grueling and pretty demanding. And I said, no, actually, they need to be wary of me. I knew the type of game that I played. I was an energetic player. I was a physical player. I liked to fight. I liked to do everything. And I knew that the fans kind of rooted the way I played hockey, right? And that's with energy, emotion, passion, commitment, loyalty. And that's, I mean, I think that's what I gave Philly. I had a bond with the Flyer fan like no other. Still today, there's not a place where I don't go to where their Philly, a person from Philly comes up and, you know, says Philly loves you. And usually I greet him with a hug. Literally every fan that comes from Philly. The one thing that was really sad is I didn't get to spend as much time in Philly as I wanted to. 3 years, then the lockout. If I could have gone back, I would have told Bobby Clarke, yeah, no thanks. I don't want to be traded. I would have used my no trade clause to stay in Philly because it, my career kind of really took a big turn from there and going to LA, coming off of two major, major concussions the year before, then having the lockout, missing an entire year, then going into LA was very difficult for me at 36 years old. It was not the time to be doing that. And my time, again, we're going into my Hall of Fame speech. My LA experience wasn't the best, but I got a few things out of it that I'll touch on November 11th that are important. But I will say one thing about LA, their fans are way underrated. They probably have one of the most underrated fan bases in all the National Hockey League. They fill that building every night. They are passionate. Obviously winning two Stanley Cups in the, 2011, 2013 was, or 12 was pretty amazing for them. And I was surprised at how great the fan base was out there.
Speaking of the Stanley Cup, you were a broadcaster with NBC in 2010, and you became very emotional when the Blackhawks won the Cup in Philadelphia. What was that night like for you?
It was split emotions, right? I mean, I'm here watching two of my favorite teams go at it in the Stanley Cup final, and probably my two most biggest fan base friendships between Chicago and Philly. I have such a close bond with both fan bases, and here I am. I'm in a win-lose situation. There's no question. Whoever wins, the other team's fans are going to be mad at me because I'm bragging or boasting about their win. I was just very surprised that seeing that cup get raised above a jersey that I worked so hard for, that I really spilt a lot of sweat and blood on trying to do that same thing, raise that cup for that city. It really hit me really hard. It was really surprising to me, and then only to get ridiculed by Mike Milbury and kind of laughed at, which was part of the relationship with Mike and I, which was funny. But, you know, Flyer fans got mad at me for that, for being emotional because the Hawks win. And, you know, I simply say, well, you guys couldn't find out how I would have reacted if the Flyers won. I probably would have had the same reaction, but you guys didn't win. Don't blame it on me. And they say fair enough and move on. But it was a really special, I think a really special Stanley Cup for me, not only to work, because it literally was my first season working in the broadcast, but then have the Hawks and Flyers in that final was very, very special.
Now, you competed in two Olympics, won a silver medal in 2002, as you referenced earlier, also played in the 91 Canada Cup. What did it mean to you to represent your country?
That's the ultimate team to play for, right? Play for your country. It's one thing to play for your city for a few million, but it's another to play for your country for 330 million. There's something about the red, white, and blue that really is deep rooted in my soul, in my heart, in my stomach. My pride is very strong. I love my country. To be able to wear the red, white, and blue is a different mentality. It's a different feeling. It's a different honor. And I got to do that numerous times in different parts of the country. To represent your country at a high level is probably one of the most special things that you can do, which is why 2002 in the Olympic gold medal game was that peak moment of my career that I will always look back and say, I can't get any higher until next week.
There you go. Now, you had a rare combination of tremendous offensive skills mixed with physicality. How did this skill set develop?
Through fear. Literally through fear. I came out of high school very small, not a physical person at all. Actually, I'd be one of those people that if I got hit, I'd probably stay on the ice a little bit longer than I should, rather than getting up and sloughing it off. it was all because of Mike Keenan. Mike Keenan pretty much made me decide in a physical sense, which I will explain in my Hall of Fame speech. Mike Keenan gave me an option. It was either play physical, play hard, play with emotion, play hurt, or don't play at all. And I had to make a decision at 18 years old. I was either going to sacrifice my body and hit everything in sight and play a physical branded game as well as an offensive branded game to be kind of a dual threat, or, you know, roll the dice on where my career would go to. I decided to play the Mike Keenan way. And what I found is it became one of my favorite parts of the game. It was something that I used as an intimidation factor. I used to hit really, really hard. I used my speed as my friend, because it wasn't my weight. It was my speed and velocity that allowed me to hit so hard. And I did that to get an edge. I needed an edge because I was small, because I wasn't as brave as I kind of portrayed. But the fans loved it. Every time I made a big hit, they cheered. Every time I made a good goal, they cheered. Every time I made a great play, they cheered. So it was just another way for me to entertain, but also have that kind of that, for lack of a better analogy, that bullet in my chamber of really instilling a little bit of fear or doubt in the defenseman's mind.
How did you manage to play through some of the injuries you suffered throughout your career?
Well, when in the beginning, I want to win. I just want to win. And I learned that pain was only temporary, but the pride is forever. The way people are going to look at you is always going to be remembered. The pain's going to go away. I've always learned to play through pain because I knew that if I lost time, if I missed games because of the little nagging injuries or the injuries that you could probably play with, but you know, some people might not want to just for mental reasons, you have a good chance of losing your job. And back, like I said, back in the late 80s, early 90s, the jobs were very few, very rare. And there's a lot of people that were competing for them. And if I miss a couple games or somebody misses a couple games and that person that comes in to replace you plays better, they're going to get the job and you're shit out of luck. So I learned to play through injury and play through pain, not only just to make sure that I kept my job, but because I wanted to win with my teammates. And I knew the pain would go away, like I said. But I think the respect that I gained from my teammates and from the fans that knew I was hurt, I think the appreciation was and respect was given back to me.
What is your best piece of advice, JR, to the young hockey player out there who has dreams of becoming the next Jeremy Roenick?
Number one, be yourself. Be yourself. You're playing a game because you love the game. You know, you love the game, live the game. And everybody says just work as hard as you possibly can. That's true. But if you want to get to the top, if you want to become a National Hockey League player, you have to live the game. You have to breathe it. You have to eat it. You have to watch it. And I think it's really important to be yourself. I mean, work is always, you know, everybody says there's different levels, right? There's stars and then there's superstars, right? So the stars are talented and people get there through work. But the superstars are always divided by how much more time they're going to put into it when the friends are asking them to go to the mall and do something different. The superstars say no. The superstars push another 20 minutes, shoot another 100 pucks. They do that extra effort. They get comfortable being uncomfortable. And I would say that would probably be the best advice that I can give somebody is be comfortable being uncomfortable. Do things that other people won't do to make sure that you become better.
As we wrap things up, JR, you are widely regarded as one of the greatest American players of all time in the history of the sport. What does that statement mean to you?
It means the world to me now at 54. I think it means more than it did when I was 25 or 30, because you watch players and you watch guys like Patrick Kane and Matthews come about, and how great that, you know, ambassadors they've been and will continue to do. But, you know, when you look at the stats and your top five, and in thousands and thousands, if not millions of people that have played the game, it's definitely humbling, and you can't help but be proud of it. It's been a good run, Kenny. It's been a really good run, and I'm so proud and humbled and thankful that it's getting capped off with a nod to the Hall of Fame. And I think finally I can let it all go and just be happy and be satisfied and just be thankful that I've had the life that I did.
Well, JR, it's so great catching up. Tremendous stories. And once again, a huge congratulations on your induction into the Hockey Hall of Fame.
Thanks, Kenny. I miss you a lot, buddy. You're doing a great job. Appreciate it.
One of the greatest American-born players in the history of the sport. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check out our other episodes as I chat with the rest of the 2024 Hockey Hall of Fame class. All episodes of NHL Induction Class are available wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to listen to the rest of the NHL's family of podcasts, including NHL Backstory. Go behind the scenes with Arne Okal as he explores some of the most significant events in hockey history and find out how they completely reshaped the game. The coordinated producers of NHL Induction Class are Bob Bender and Matt Nicholson. Special thanks to editorial consultant Phil Constantino. The executive producer of NHL Productions is Steve Mayer. I'm Kenny Albert. Congratulations to Jeremy Roenick on his induction into the Hockey Hall of Fame.